Okay, welcome. Great to see so many people joining on this rainy Wednesday. If it's raining where you are, it's raining where I am. Want to wish everyone who is celebrating a happy Eid, a happy solstice week. Hope that people are feeling good today and ready to learn about this important, very important topic, Neni, which I believe we've done some teach-ins on in the past, but it's been a while. So really delighted that so many people are joining. You know, sometimes solar and electric vehicles get a lot of the attention and excitement with the transition off fossil fuels, but energy efficiency is really the cornerstone and the critical piece in how we're going to effectively transition. So very much looking forward to hearing from our speakers today about how we're going to spend this $5 billion on making sure that we can achieve our building decarbonization goals in New York State. So it's 12:03. I think we won't waste too much more time on intros because we have four great speakers to hear from today. We're going to start with Chris Cole, who some of you may know. Chris previously was at NYSERDA and now is at the New York State Department of Service as the project director in the Office of Markets and Innovation. And Chris, as always, is an incredible champion for low to moderate income households and just one of those public servants that we are so grateful to have here in New York, doing wonderful work at the state level. So thank you so much, Chris, for being here. And thanks everybody for joining us today at your lunch hour to learn and hopefully take action as we move forward with New Efficiency New York and unlocking the power of NENI. Love that title. That was my NYCP colleagues who came up with that. So and thanks to them for being here as always, holding it down and organizing these great teach-ins. So Chris, thank you so much for being here. Toss it over to you. And I know you're going to present and then you're going to do like a Q&A just so everybody knows. Right. We'll keep your questions for, get your quick questions ready for Chris and he'll answer them. And then Chris will jump and we'll move on to our other speakers and then have another Q&A at the end because we always want to make sure we get to people's questions. And if we don't get to everybody's questions today, we always capture them in a Google Doc and then we'll send the Google Doc around after and, you know, after we've been able to get those questions answered so people don't leave feeling like they're still wondering, how did that work or, you know, how can I participate more actively in this proceeding? So just want to make sure that people know that we will be capturing your questions and concerns and getting back to you if we don't answer them all today. So I think that's about it for me, and then I'll pass it over to you, Chris.
Great. Thanks, Betta. And thanks again to the team at New Yorkers for Clean Power for organizing this awesome event. And just want to thank you all for participating. I know it's sometimes hard to find, you know, a time in the day to engage on a topic like this, but like I'm personally glad that you're all here because you know, like Betta said at the outset, this is an important topic. And the more that we can get residents and communities, you know, aware of what's happening kind of in these important proceedings, the more we can kind of, you know, ensure that your voices are incorporated into kind of how decisions get made, right? So, so anyhow, just by way of introduction, so I, you know, as Betta said, I work at the Department of Public Service, and I'm part of a team of a number of DPS staff that are responsible for the New Efficiency New York proceeding. And so the other term we're starting to use for New Efficiency New York is energy efficiency and building electrification. It's just kind of another way to kind of refer to this proceeding. But essentially, you know, myself and the team that I work with are, you know, supporting the work that the Public Service Commission does, right? So ultimately, the Public Service Commission is going to be deciding kind of what this portfolio looks like, how the programs, you know, ultimately will look and be available, how they'll be available to residents and communities. It's important, you know, the last thing I'll kind of say at the outset is it's important for the department and also for myself to make sure we're increasing engagement on these issues. So as I mentioned earlier, you know, getting everyone's voice on the record and kind of, you being able to share your opinions, will ultimately help inform what the commission, you know, decides, you know, in this proceeding. And so, it's an important kind of, thing that we're trying to do at the Department of Public Service to, you know, ensure that we're kind of increasing our ability to engage and kind of hear from, residents that, you know, these programs and portfolios are ultimately affecting. And so, what I want to do with the little bit of time we have this afternoon is to provide an overview of this this broader proceeding. You know, as I know it can be difficult to kind of follow kind of what's happening kind of in the regulatory environment, and, you know, give folks a chance to ask any questions if you have any for me before you continue with the rest of the program for today. So with that, can we go to the next slide, Lisa? Okay. So, as I mentioned, you know, we're also kind of using, the Energy Efficiency and Building Electrification, for short EEBE, as kind of, you know, another name for NENE. But just to give you a sense for kind of like how we got here today, we're really talking about the, you know, the 2026 through 2030, set of programs that'll be funded through ratepayer, collections. And so I think, if you're not aware, you know, on your electric bill, on your gas bill every month, you do have kind of a collection or a surcharge that you're paying, you know, into support the administration of clean energy programs, right? And so, one of those, sets of programs is this, you know, energy efficiency and building electrification, you know, set of, initiatives. And so, we're talking about kind of the future kind of incarnation or future iteration of, you know, what's currently the NYSERDA Clean Energy Fund. So there's a number of, programs that NYSERDA administers. And for those of you who aren't familiar with NYSERDA, the New York State Energy Research and Development Authority, you know, so they have programs that are supporting, low to moderate income households, as well as, you know, low income households to kind of, you know, improve energy efficiency of their home. They have programs for commercial and industrial projects. They support engagement, with communities, workforce development, so on and so forth. So, you know, we're kind of thinking about that set of programs that NYSERDA runs, as well as, the set of energy efficiency programs that the utilities are currently administering. So no matter where you are in the state, it's likely that there are, utilities that your utility is administering one of these programs. And there's some nuances. So if you have, an electric, utility that is, municipal, electric, you might not pay into this, you know, surcharge, and some of these programs might not be available to you. But for the most part, a large majority of residents are, you know, covered through these programs. And so the energy efficiency and building electrification portfolio that we're talking about was initially kind of, kicked off back in September of 2022, when the Public Service Commission started, doing an interim review of New Efficiency New York and the Clean Energy Fund. Next slide, please. And I'll just give you a little bit more, you know, background in terms of how we got to where we are today and what to expect, you know, kind of in the short term. But, you know, there was, you know, from that initial kind of kickoff of the review of the Clean Energy Fund and New Efficiency New York, the DPS staff, the folks that I work with, filed a report that outlined, you know, what's working, what's not working, and asking stakeholders and, you know, interested parties to provide their input on a series of questions that ultimately led to a commission order So the way that the Public Service Commission typically works is, there will be kind of issues that are kind of, deliberated, and they'll essentially kind of issue, what we call an order, which outlines kind of the, you know, the requirements that will be imposed on, you know, the utility or NYSERDA, and, kind of lay out kind of what's expected, as well as describing the rationale that the commission had in making their decision. And so that July order, kind of laid out expectations for this energy efficiency and building electrification, portfolio, which I'll talk more about in just a minute. And since then, there was, you know, a series of proposals that were provided by the utilities and NYSERDA, who were primarily administering these programs, that we're going to be speaking about. If some of you, I think, were able to attend, the utilities and NYSERDA hosted a couple of technical conferences. So essentially, they presented their proposals publicly and allowed for folks to ask questions. Those occurred in February, and then currently, comments on the proposals that were filed by NYSERDA and the utilities are due on April 15th. However, I just want to flag for those of you that have been following, or maybe not following, the Secretary to the Commission just recently received a request to extend the deadline for comments to be filed. And so it's likely that the secretary will act on that in the next day or so. So there's the potential that there might be an additional 30 days added to this timeline for when comments need to be filed. And so we could talk more about what that could mean a little bit later. Next slide, please. So this is, you know, kind of really where the July order kind of started, you know. So as Beta said earlier, there's $5 billion that's being contemplated here. And this July order established an annual budget for these programs at $1 billion. And so that kind of is across the multiple program administrators. So all of the investor-owned utilities, as well as NYSERDA. And that budget is supporting both low and moderate income programs and non-low and moderate income programs, by which these proposals that the utilities and NYSERDA filed are supposed to be responsive to. It did a number of other things, including set up what we're calling a strategic framework. So essentially, you know, providing some guide rails about what sort of measures and so energy efficiency measures or projects should be prioritized to help align, you know, these portfolios with the state's Climate Act and our kind of drive to decarbonize buildings. So we really want to focus on more impactful measures and projects if we can. It kind of re-stated and imposed the Climate Act's requirement that at least 35% of benefits tied to this spending should be going to disadvantaged communities. It laid out roles and responsibilities for NYSERDA and the utilities. And then it also kind of importantly paused what the utilities are calling, or what we call for the utilities, earnings adjustment mechanisms. So this is kind of a way for the utilities to earn kind of their kind of incentives. So if they meet certain goals, they can get an incentive according to their EAMs. And so this order paused any new incentives that utilities could earn under the energy efficiency and building electrification framework. And then lastly, we also kind of, through this order, allowed for the utilities and NYSERDA to propose changes for their budget, you know, kind of distribution prior to 2025. Next slide, please. And I want to be conscious of the time, so I'll just kind of speak to the next few slides. And I think, as Beta said earlier, this information will be made available to everyone after the conversation. But just at a high level, kind of roles and responsibilities. So the commission wanted to really kind of look at the state's administrators here, the utilities and NYSERDA, and look at kind of collectively how to create the greatest impact based on who's kind of administering what program, where their strengths are, that sort of thing. So they landed with, you know, NYSERDA being the primary administrator statewide to be responsible for workforce development initiatives, things like codes and standards, technical assistance, consumer awareness, demonstration projects where it makes sense. And then importantly, NYSERDA would be the primary administrator for low to moderate income programs across the state, with the exception of the affordable multifamily programs in the New York metro area, which Con Edison and National Grid will continue to administer. And then the utilities are going to be responsible for all of the, you know, standard incentive programs, including New York Clean Heat, so the heat pump incentive program. And we really want to, you know, as we're kind of thinking about the utilities, making sure that, you know, there's alignment across what the utilities that share service territories are kind of rolling out, right? So to create kind of or to reduce the potential for kind of confusion or overlap or redundancy for, you know, customers. If you have, you know, multiple utilities that, you know, one provides gas, one provides electric. So we want some consistency there. And we also want consistency for contractors that are kind of working across utility territories. Next slide, please. And so the order also kind of outlined several requirements for what the proposals that the utilities and NYSERDA were ultimately supposed to file. So what those proposals should include. Just at a high level here, you know, the important components, like obviously what is the program supposed to achieve? What are the budgets? What are the savings? The commission also asked each of the administrators to identify where and how they would propose to be flexible in terms of shifting their budgets between years, right? So sometimes it's a lot more beneficial if, you know, the administrator can, you know, fund projects as they come in. So maybe not kind of keep a standard, you know, budget every year. Maybe you can kind of fund a little bit more in one year, and as demand increases and then as demand decreases in future years, potentially, you know, have a less of a budget. So we allowed for proposals for how funding could be shifted between years, how the costs of these programs would be recovered. So essentially the, you know, collection that is happening on every utility bill, there's different ways to kind of look at that collection. And so we asked for the administrators to propose how that would work. And then we would want to make sure that, you know, each of these proposals are specifically talking about how they could ensure the disadvantaged communities across the state would benefit through these programs. And importantly, how do they work together, right? How do they coordinate between programs and in NYSERDA? Next slide, please. To wrap up here and open up for questions, but just want to give you guys a sense for the magnitude of what we're talking about here. So we're kind of collectively looking at almost $4 billion that is going to be supporting energy efficiency and building electrification initiatives across the market, right? So, you know, whether that's for residential projects, commercial, industrial, small business, and then another $1.5 billion that would be dedicated to low to moderate income households or affordable housing, right? So these, you know, this aggregate budget is over 5 years. And one of the things to flag here is while the commission has established a total of $5 billion for these programs, what that didn't include was like labor costs, you know, administrative costs tied to labor for the administration of these programs. And so what you're seeing here kind of collectively would be, you know, the total costs, you know, plus administrative costs and labor. Next slide, please. And so one of the things that, you know, we thought would be helpful to kind of break down for folks, because, you know, it's very difficult, right, for you to kind of work through. I think what we ultimately wound up with was like, 12 or so proposals to review. And, you know, it's hard for everyone to kind of go through those and kind of aggregate the, you know, what's being proposed for budgets and savings and impacts, right? So, the next couple of slides just kind of provide a breakdown of the proposed budgets and, some savings metrics that would be, for the non-low to moderate income portfolio and the low to moderate income portfolio. One thing that I'll kind of, just mention here is, you know, we're providing a dollar per MMBTU equivalent, so the last two columns, just to kind of provide kind of one lens to look at kind of the overall kind of cost effectiveness of running these programs as it pertains to achieving MMBTU equivalents, right? So that's like so that's just one way to look at it, right? The commission did not establish that this metric should be the only metric that we care about. There could be other ways to look at the, you know, the effectiveness, of these portfolios, just to kind of make sure that that's clear. We're not making decisions just solely on, MMBTU, equivalents. Next slide. And so, this would be the, low to moderate income, portfolio budget. So, as we mentioned already, about $1.5 billion and annually $223 million a year across the utilities in NYSERDA. One of the things that you'll see here, just I want to make sure it's clear. As I mentioned, roles and responsibilities that were outlined by the commission have NYSERDA being the primary administrator for low to moderate income programs. That is the case. And so, in this chart, you see NYSERDA with the bulk of the budgets. However, for the New York metro area where Con Edison and National Grid through their KEDLI and KEDNY service territories are operating, they do have budgets to support their work there. So, Lisa, I don't know if you want to maybe go to the next slide, and then I'll kind of open up for some questions if folks have. So the next few slides outline what the secretary to the commission kind of posed as questions for stakeholders to contemplate as you're providing comments. I'm not going to go through all of them, just in the interest of time. But one of the things to flag here is the comments that you file will be going to the document and matter management system, DMM. And I could drop a link into the chat if that would be helpful. But essentially all of the comments that stakeholders and interested parties file will be posted publicly. So you can kind of see what others have kind of commented about this proceeding. You can look at the proposals themselves. You can look at, you know, the technical conference slides and associated information that I mentioned previously. So there's a lot of resources there as well if you're interested. But with that, let me just pause there and maybe, Beta, do we want to take some questions if folks have them?
Sure. Yeah, that would be great.
Time? Yeah.
Thanks so much, Chris. It's a ton to cover, and it's a lot of information for the people who have been, like you, who have been reviewing all of this, and many of the advocates on this meeting going through all of these proposals is just, you know, incredibly time-consuming and complicated. So kudos to everyone who's been working on this and trying to keep up. But thank you for that brief synopsis about, you know, where we're at. So we've got some good questions in the chat. Some we already tried to answer. I think we'll probably bypass the do you support the New York Heat Act since, you know, Chris isn't as part of DPS supposed to weigh in on legislation. But I can say that many of us on the call are working fervently to get New York Heat across the finish line. But as a member of DPS, Chris would be on the sidelines of that one.
I think we've got some good questions here in the chat. And if you have your hand raised, if you wouldn't mind just typing into the chat, that would be great since we have more than 100 people on the webinar. It would be just great to see your questions in the chat. So Chris,
and then we can capture them in our doc and make sure they get answered.
Chris Sandlin asks, can a third-party business partner with a utility gain access to CEFE program funding, or does it have to be through a local government?
So if I interpret the question correctly, a third party, a contractor contractor for a utility. And if that's the case, the path to accessing funding through these programs would be to participate in one of the utility or NYSERDA programs. So you potentially could be, a contractor delivering these programs. Or if you are working for a municipality, which I also kind of heard in that question, municipalities would have the ability to apply for funding. So one of the things that's important to kind of remember with these proposals, right? They're not fully baked. So when you kind of look at what was proposed by the utilities in NYSERDA, some of them have specific programs. Others have concepts or ideas, for programs or markets that they would serve. And so my recommendation would be, if you have specific comments or things that you would like to see in these, in this future iteration of this portfolio, and it wasn't spoken about in the proposals, this is your opportunity to, to share your perspective, in comments that go into the Public Service Commission. So I certainly would recommend you kind of including that there.
That's great. Thanks, Chris. And if that didn't answer the gentleman's question, we will follow up. Carol asks, is all the money, all the $5 billion coming from surcharges on utility bills?
Yeah, so this whole portfolio of programs that we're talking about today is all ratepayer funded. So the funding is collected from every ratepayer's bill. So residential customers, commercial customers, institutional customers.
Great. Thank you for that. And Andy Foster from the Adirondacks wants to know, how can we address and reach folks that are low or moderate income outside of DACs, which is disadvantaged communities, in the rural areas such as the Adirondacks where he lives and works?
Yeah, so that's a very good question, and one that I know, just working with a number of folks on this call and with others that are working to create access to these programs for folks who face barriers accessing them, outreach within rural parts of the state or, even within disadvantaged communities, right, can be challenging. And so there are some initiatives that are currently funded. The regional clean energy hubs, for instance, I know we have a number of representatives from hubs that are kind of on the call today. Those organizations are doing this sort of outreach and looking for solutions to, address the barriers that, underrepresented or, under-resourced communities are facing when it comes to accessing these programs. So I would kind of first plug the hubs as a way to kind of reach some of these households. And then the other thing I would say is, if you do have specific, communities or parts of the state that are, are underrepresented, it would be good to kind of, raise that to those that are administering the programs to make sure that we can, increase outreach and engagement in those parts of the state.
Awesome. We have so many good questions here. I'm going to choose Mark's question, which is the $5 billion question, is how do we help renters who don't have control over these decisions and the buildings that they live in? So thoughts about that.
Yeah, Mark, if you, that's a question we always ask ourselves as well. I mean, one of the things to remember is obviously some of the issues that we're trying to face here are really like multidisciplinary. So, yes, we might have funding that could be directed towards, improving the efficiency of rental properties, but then we have this whole other challenge of, you know, how do we get absentee landlords, or how do we get landlords that, you know, they may not be absentee landlords, but maybe they just don't have the resources to, you know, kind of invest in projects, you know, on their property at the moment. So it's a challenge that we're facing, and we've always faced across the programs that we're administering.
It goes a little bit on my...
Oh, sorry.
I think that's you, Lisa. I think you're freezing, not Chris.
Yeah. So just to, you know, in short to say, you know, it's been a longstanding challenge, and, you know, looking at ways to better engage landlords to kind of explain, you know, how these sorts of programs, how these sorts of improvements to their property can actually be beneficial for them as well as their tenants is something that, you know, we're really interested in trying to do a better job in. So the more that, you know, we can have this conversation and, you know, think about how to solve for that split incentive issue is going to be really important.
Thanks, Chris. And I wish we could have just like had you for the whole hour. Because there's so many great.
I'm
questions.
Sorry. I figured there'd be a lot of.
But we will definitely capture these great questions and you know, bug you for the answers and get back to people, the ones we can't answer, that is, so that everybody does get their questions answered. The one I just wanted to raise that is a little pressing from John Rath is, you know, can and should our organizations be sending a note to the secretary about the need for an extension? Because, you know, as we were saying, there is such an enormous amount of information, you know, in these proposals that having more time to put in substantive comments would be incredibly helpful. I don't know if that's, you know, worth doing for organizations or what you would advise there.
Yeah, so, you know, my advice would be, you know, if you all think that it's necessary to be able to formulate your comments, you know, and that you have that option to you know, submit a request for an extension. And like I mentioned earlier, there is a request that was submitted late last week that is being considered right now. So so it's really kind of a, you know, a question that you'll have to answer. It's like, if you think it's worthwhile, then I think you certainly have that option. So the other thing I'll say is I'm happy to follow up separately as well on any questions that folks, you know, didn't get answered today. So, you know, feel free to let me know.
Thank you. And we'll keep our fingers crossed for that extension to buy us a little more time here, because I think we all have a lot to say and contribute to this important topic. And it would be great to have a little bit more time. But given we're running out of time now, and I want to make sure we hear from our other speakers, just want to thank you again so much, Chris, for being here, for all of your incredible work. We're, you know, very fortunate to have you at DPS, and looking forward to working together to achieve our climate goals and our building decarbonization goals in New York. So thank you.
Thanks, Beta. Thanks, everyone. Have a good rest of the program.
Thank you. So next up, we are going to hear from Linda Nguyen, who is from Kinetic Communities Consulting. Sorry about that. Which, for people who are working on equitable building decarbonization, are very familiar with KC3's incredible work. And we're so lucky to have Linda here today to walk us through some of the issues that they're facing on the ground, working with building owners, mostly downstate, a lot of multifamily, but also 1-4s, and some of the issues that you're looking to have addressed in the new iteration of these programs. So thank you so much, Linda, for being here and for all the great work that KC3 does on the ground.
Thanks, Beta, and thank you to the team for having me. My name is Linda Nguyen. I use she/her pronouns, program manager here at KC3, Kinetic Communities Consulting. If you can go to the next slide, Lisa, that'd be great. I'm putting our website in the chat for folks who want to just dig in a little bit and learn more about us. So KC3 works to make affordable housing in the downstate region mainly more energy efficient. I'm having conversations with building owners, their support teams every day to demystify energy efficiency affordability and to also help them navigate the very confusing patchwork of different energy efficiency programs, their funding and their rules so folks get the funding and support they need to do the energy efficiency work that we want to see through what Chris just walked us through with the NEMI filings. Next slide, please, Lisa. So our approach, we kind of work like case managers. We connect with building owners, their teams to learn about their needs and priorities. We're identifying different energy efficiency programs and the fundings that folks could tap into to do the work that they want. And then we're also supporting them well into project completion. So we're there with them every step of the way until their project closes out and they get their final incentive check, which is really helpful. It's kind of like a all-in-one stop shop to support folks to do this type of work. So how folks like the utilities, NYSERDA, the program administrators that Chris outlined at the top of the call, are supporting buildings doing this work is a really big focus right now, especially within the world of electrification. The Public Service Commission really wants buildings to be electrified or get as electrification ready as possible. And they want these energy efficiency programs to support that work happening on the ground, which, you know, begs the question, why aren't more buildings doing this? What's going on? How do we get more folks to electrify and do these energy efficiency upgrades? Next slide, please. Okay, so I've prepared a case study for folks here to kind of ground some of our talking points. Sometimes case studies are more helpful. This is a really old building, more than 100 years old, small, affordable condo on number 2 oil, and they want to electrify. They want to electrify their water and their hot water and steam systems, which is great. That's exactly what the commission wants. That's what we've been rallying for on the ground for a very long time now. And so it's great to see kind of buildings want to do this work. They've been getting a lot of quotes, thinking their project's probably going to cost around $500,000, and they want to apply to a couple of different energy efficiency programs to get some supportive funding, right? They specifically identify Clean Heat and NYSERDA's Low Carbon Pathways program for incentives. And now they're on their journey to figure out how to make this happen. They're encountering a couple of issues. Next slide, please. So those two programs they want to apply to, only covering 10% of their project costs, right? So that leaves a whopping 90% of the project need to be covered by the building owner. So they're looking at needing to get a large sum of capital at either low cost or that's totally forgivable to keep this project affordable and successful. They've applied to several different programs specifically designed to support affordable housing, and they were denied for various reasons. And the only option they had left on the table were commercial loans. And they were offering, you know, interest rates that were 8 to 10%, which were, you know, just financially infeasible for this building. Next slide, please. And so I hope that case study provides some color into what folks on the ground are experiencing when they're trying to electrify and do decarbonization work. I've kind of categorized these major issues into three buckets here to kind of help us parse through it. The first is money, right? Right now, to electrify, a lot of affordable housing buildings need to find funding either through government subsidies or private financing to make electrification happen, or even just general energy efficiency work a reality, right? Most of these programs are only covering equipment costs. In our case study example, it was, you know, covering about 10% of the project. 90% has to be covered by the building. Once we install this equipment, the cost to operate and maintain these systems are also going to be borne by the building owner, right? So the cost to train building staff how to operate these systems, the cost to repair these systems, that's all going to fall on the building owner. The next issue I want to talk through is energy burden. So energy burden is a metric folks use to measure affordability. They define this as no more than 6% of a tenant or a resident's income going towards paying for utility bills, if I'm not correct there. Folks can correct me in the chat. But I think this is really interesting because a lot of folks who are working in this space are concerned that with the rise of electrification comes the rise of housing and electricity, right? And that's a valid concern. So we're really thinking about how to make this more affordable. So just kind of expand on that a little bit more. Providing electric heat can be really costly. For tenants who are living in buildings that were previously having their gas heat included in their rent to now being in a building where they're having to pay for their heating through their electric bill, they're going to see a rise in costs in their electric bill. For owners who are having to pay for heating in their buildings going from gas heat to electric heat, they're also going to see a rise in electric costs as well. There are only very few energy affordability programs in the market right now to support on this specific issue, and they're not adequate in providing the financial aid needed, and they're really segmented, only kind of supporting low-income residents. And so all of these compounding factors, including kind of the rising rents, is kind of a perfect storm for unaffordability, which is not great. The last issue I want to talk through is New York's building stock. So the case study example, their structure was pretty okay, which is great, but not all buildings share the same fate. New York is a really old city. Our buildings are crumbling on older systems, and a lot of them have health and safety issues that need to be resolved before they even think about electrification. So that's like fixing the cracks and leaks in their building, removing asbestos, and they have to resolve all these issues before they even put in a fancy heat pump, right? A lot of times, these health and safety issues are not being incentivized for these programs, and so there's already a kind of a barrier that folks have to push through before they can think about electrification. There's also a lot of buildings in New York running on oil, and there aren't a lot of energy efficiency programs incentivizing measures for buildings on oil. And these two things are bad, right? Buildings, older buildings and buildings running on oil typically have the highest carbon, they're typically the highest carbon emitters. Their residents also have the highest energy burden. So once again, we're seeing folks being left behind because of the issues of access and affordability, which is not great. What can we do about it? Next slide, please, Lisa. So there's always going to be something that can be done. I've only just brainstormed a couple of ideas here. The first thing I want to talk through is tenant protections. Tenant protections need to go hand in hand with scaled electrification, so we're not leaving folks behind in the transition, right? This can look like programmatic or legislative ideas. On the programmatic side, the utilities and NYSERDA can work together to make their programs more accessible. There are clear recommendations and proposals in the NANI filings that speak to this, right? Common application that could be used across all different programs. A support portal, maybe a Know Your Rights campaign so folks know what they can do. Legislatively, that could look like passing the HEAT Act. That could look like passing Good Cause. So there are a lot of different ideas that folks have put forward that can really tackle the tenant protections piece. The second thing I want to talk through is electrification readiness. Those heat and health and safety measures need to be incentivized. Things like electrical upgrades need to be incentivized, and that incentive funding should be provided incrementally or upfront, not the very end. So we're finding a consistent stream of support for buildings that are super cash-strapped and want to do this work. Next thing I want to talk to you, expand the affordability programs we have on the market. Right now, a lot of them are modeled after gas heat, and that's a lot cheaper than electric heat. We need to update these programs and modernize them so more folks can access them, and we can really tackle that affordability issue. And then lastly, changing metrics. Right now, a lot of folks are looking at total projects completed and energy saved as the key kind of metric here to define success. Those tables that Chris shared in the beginning of this presentation kind of allude to that, right? I'm thinking we should focus on energy burden. Number of projects completed and energy saved does not fully capture all the issues affordable housing tenants and owners are navigating, and thinking about energy burden can really help be a more dynamic metric to define success. And that is all I have for folks today. Thank you so much, and I'll be happy to answer questions at the end.
Thank you so much, Linda. That was great. And I'm sure people will have questions. You covered a lot. And again, appreciate all the good work that you and KC3 do. So next up, we are going to be hearing from another practitioner, Judith Karpova from Green Pathway Consultants. Judith is a home energy efficiency specialist and has been working in the Hudson Valley to make homes more efficient, healthier for quite some time, and I believe is also still a board member of Communities for Local Power, as am I, and delighted to have you here, Judith, as an active implementer of these programs and hear from you some of the challenges that you face in your work on the ground. Oh, you're muted still though.
Okay. Can you hear me now?
Perfect.
Okay, great. I am kind of approaching this from the other end. We've been looking at overviews of statewide programs, federal funding that's running into the billions of dollars. And my experience for almost 20 years has been going into just simply one home at a time and going into one attic and one crawl space at a time and getting spider webs up my nose and fiberglass behind my ears and in my hair. But as incremental and small as my scope in a way has been, over time you start to see trends. Could I see the first slide? That's an attic with a fan. Could I see the next slide? That's what's in that attic. That's a combination of old vermiculite, which was originally manufactured with asbestos, and fiberglass, which is totally exposed to the air. Now, we've just seen that attic fan. What's being shed by these materials in that attic doesn't just stay in the attic. It goes out of the attic, onto the streets, and into the breathing air of the town, of the city. Where does it also go? In older homes where your attic floors haven't been sealed to cut them off from the rest of the house, that fiberglass turns into tiny little particles of resins and binders and glass. It goes down the walls of the home and comes out at all the electrical outlets and into the breathing air. A house, air moves through a house from bottom to top and top to bottom. So any contaminant you have in the house is going to move in summer as cooler air inside the house sinks. All this stuff in the attic, and we're not even looking at what might be living in the fiberglass. Can I have the next slide? Need I say what I find living in fiberglass and all the little calling cards? Next slide, please. This is an air conditioning system where it's been insulated, but inadequately and not properly secured, so that fiberglass is still exposed to the air of the attic. In summer, as that air sinks, it gets pulled down through the house. In winter, as air rises, anything that's in the basement is pulled upward through those rising currents of air, upward through the house and out the top through those leaky attics. Could I have the next slide? That's a basement ceiling that's been covered with fiberglass. This building element called the rim joist, which is where you see that brick wall in the back, that's where the basement transitions to the wooden framing. Well, that part is called the rim joist, and it's where air from outside moves in and air from inside moves out. And air from outside also moves into all of these ceiling studs through that fiberglass. So this fiberglass, as you can see, is connected to the basement air that gets pulled upward through the house. Well, as an energy auditor, what I see in house after house is fiberglass, and I've become a little bit of a fanatic about it because it's extremely toxic. It's very damaging to lungs. So the first thing you want to do before you even think of making a house tighter, with less air movement going through it to dilute these contaminants, you want to get rid of this. You don't want to have anything that's going to trigger asthma, and about 20 other problems that particularized fiberglass causes asthma. I can send anyone a list of, I mean, they haven't found it to cause cancer, but there's like an enormous health impact of having this stuff in your home. Well, the point is, after that really long windup, who's paying for that removal? NYSERDA programs, including the new efficiency New York program, the weatherization programs, they are all monetized. They're all based on return on investment. We're going to invest so much in a building. Notice they're not saying the occupants and the health and safety of the occupants of that building. They're talking only about the structure itself as if it's separate from who lives in it. The only purpose of a building is to shelter and harbor its occupants and to give them a place to thrive and grow. And when that building is toxic, those people do not thrive. They do not grow. They are sometimes taken out of economic viability. They get sick. They go to emergency rooms instead of going to their jobs or to their schools. And NYSERDA is not funding these health and safety measures. So we've just seen a very elaborate and complex and hard-fought set of programs and goals and ambitions. And what I'm not seeing, and what's to me is glaringly absent from the low and moderate income goals, is the coverage of health and safety factors, money to remove indoor air quality contaminants, like mold, not just fiberglass. There's like mouse leavings, sewer backups. Maybe there's been a pipe burst and the drywall has started to turn into dust. You can't breathe this stuff. And you can't tighten a house and air seal it and lock it in with its occupants. And what I've seen time after time in weatherization programs is that there's just no money to get it off your attic floors. So weatherization contractors are actually allowed to put new, clean, fresh insulation right over it. What does that do? That seals contaminants into the conditioned envelope of the building.
Judith, thank you so much for flagging all of this, and I'm sorry to rush
That's
you.
That's fine. That's fine.
No, I mean, and your passion for addressing these health hazards properly and making sure that we are helping people, you know, have healthier homes and not breathe in these toxics is, you know, really appreciated. And I know how dedicated you are.
You don't have to go on. Let's go on to the next speaker. So I've already trampled all over her.
but the good news is that we have an opportunity, right, to build our movement for healthy, cleaner homes. And it's on that note that I'm going to pass it over to Eric Walker, who has been working hard on this proceeding, pulling together a lot of different folks to get their input on what's important. Eric is the Energy Justice Senior Policy Manager at We Act for Environmental Justice, an important ally, and is going to let us all know what we can do next to take action to help address some of these barriers on the road to building decarbonization. Eric?
Thanks, Beta. Just so want to appreciate everyone for taking the time out of the day. I'm going to be super quick because we're running out of time. We have four ways to take action today. One of which is if you have not signed on to an organizational sign-on letter that we're circulating with folks, we encourage everybody to take a quick look at that sign-on and then join. It's in the chat right now. And it's essentially working with a few of our key partners, Better Buildings New York, which is a coalition of several organizations that includes We Act, New Yorkers for Clean Power, the Alliance for Green Economy, and others, as well as some key partners, KC3, Rewiring America, and Wind Climate. And we have three really major objectives in our letter. One is to invest in our communities, right? We need to allocate 50% of the NENI budget to the LMI and addressing these electrification and energy efficiency readiness issues that Judith and Linda so eloquently highlighted. The second thing is making programs easy to use and making them easy for customers and contractors to participate in. We've heard over and over and over from implementers on the ground, community-based organizations, and other stewards of these programs that customer navigation and contractor participation is difficult and that we need to make them simpler in order to get to scale and then make that make participating in those programs simpler so that people want to do it. The second thing, as we've heard already, is valuing our health and our safety, right? Judith in particular went into a lot of detail around the actual health implications of having poorly insulated or poor insulation workmanship and what that could do to folks living indoors and also to the surrounding communities. We've heard about the need to incentivize that from Linda in a really deep way so that it is not a barrier to program participation because it is a prerequisite to actually getting energy efficiency and electrification work done. We need to value the work that gets done in order to support people moving through the programs. So please take a look at the sign-on. There's also, for those of you, for everyone else here, there's other ways to take action. We have essentially three other ways to take action. I'm going to drop another form in the chat for you as well. The three basic ways are, one, join us on April 18th to deliver the letter that the sign-on, organizational sign-on will be generated from, to deliver that to Chair Rory Christensen of the Public Service Commission and the two newly installed and confirmed commissioners who we think are going to be instrumental in advancing these key objectives of NENI. The second thing is to write your own comment. If you would like to add more to the dialogue, put something into the docket because we think that extension is likely, we're happy to support you doing that. We have what are called NENI office hours to support folks in the drafting of those comments, and we'll drop a link to the other ways to take action right now into the chat. Third is to tell your story, right? For other program participants, contractors, and other interested parties, we'd love to hear more about your experiences with these programs, and those can also be entered into the docket as comments to help inform and let the commission know where the direction of these programs should go. So by all means, please, take a look at the organizational sign-on letter. The link is in the chat. We'd love to have your name and add your name to the list of folks who support those key objectives and let us know about the other ways you'd like to take action, and I'll hand it back to Beta.
Thanks, Eric. I know that was a lot, but we will be sending a follow-up. So don't think you had to absorb all of that and do all of that instantly. I know it's already 1 o'clock and this hour flew by, clearly too much to cover in 1 hour. But I think a few of our speakers are willing to stay on for a few extra minutes. So if people can, stay on for a few minutes, we'll try to address a couple of questions at least live here. And then we'll make sure to copy them all into a Google Doc and get answers and get back to you with the recording and the slides and the links to take action. Thank you, speakers, for staying on a few more minutes and everybody for being here. That this has really been terrific. So going back to a couple of questions that, or at least one question we'll get to Linda, and then we'll maybe save the other ones. But one, I think, important one that was raised is, what regulations, legislation, incentives are being proposed to address energy burden? Can you expand a little bit on your thoughts, given some of the challenges there, especially, for both LMI and multifamily residential buildings? The cost to electrify is a big concern. And, are there any suggestions that you would make specifically for how that can be addressed?
Sure. So, thank you for that question. This really resonates with me because I don't want folks to have to bear the brunt of, the transition, right? I do think the HEAT Act would codify energy burden definition, the 6%, which is really exciting. It also gives the Public Service Commission the authority to align much of the energy efficiency work With the environmental justice mandates in the CLCPA, the Climate Protection and Community Leadership Act. So that's really exciting, right? And I think hopefully we see that passed. I'm speaking for myself. I would love to see that passed. But I think that'd be great. New York does have pretty strict rent stabilization laws. And so hopefully that's a layer of protection that we can lean on as electrification continues to become more popular in the state. It would be great if we saw other proposed legislation passed by the legislature. Good cause is one of them. I think we could also think about other ideas around the affordability piece. How can we expand some of the existing affordability programs? And that's really on like the PLC's like realm of influence to do. So there's a lot there. I'm not sure if I got to all of the points of the question.
Hi, I'm on a call right now. Can I call you right back?
Okay. thank you, Linda. No, that was great, and appreciate the shout out for New York Heat. So those of you who are willing to send an email, make a phone call, please do. This is the 11th hour for that important legislation. And Eric, did you want to chime in something?
No, I was just going to make sure that before we left, we plugged the sign on and take action form before we close out for the day.
Okay. Yes. We can do that again before we go, but let's try to get to a couple more questions. Lisa, do you want to ask the next one?
How's my audio?
Good.
Okay, great. So, I was just going to share the link. So you caught me off guard there. So, there are some comments about different kinds of insulation products and materials, which we just don't have time to go into a detailed discussion about those. Then Dave has a comment about the air to heat recovery system. So as you tighten up a home, you actually get to a point where you actually need to pump outside air into that home, right? And then you don't want to lose heat when you're doing that, so you have to have a way to have a heat exchange when you're doing that. I would only dream of having such an airtight home myself, since my house was built in 1840. Peter wants to know how much a New York State Climate Act policy can activate healthy homes for New York State, as Bush Buffalo has called for. Read about healthy homes programs in the Northwest, like Washington and Oregon, that often involves both energy and health. And that exactly, Peter, is one of our top asks. Does anyone want to comment about energy policy having to include the impact on the people that live in the building, as Judith so rightly said? Judith, maybe you want to take that one. But you are muted, my friend.
Okay. I'm glad to find out about this program, these programs in the Northwest, and I'm going to look into them and see what approach they've taken. I know that Alliance for a Green Economy has been working on what they call gap funding to provide money, and it would have to be passed by the state legislature for when, especially in poorer communities where people may not be able to afford to have contaminated materials taken out of their home before those homes are made more energy efficient. But the legislature has really been the source of the NYSERDA policy. I don't blame NYSERDA. The legislature requires them to realize a return on investment. You're going to put so much money into a house. What is the savings going to be that's realized from that investment in the house? well, health and safety measures don't have a return on investment for the energy usage of the house. They just have a return on investment for the viability of the people who live in the house. So that's where the breakthrough needs to happen. The ability of residents to thrive in the house has to be valued, and not just the building, which may have people moving in and out of it, but it can't be a building that turns the people who live in it sick until maybe you finally get people who have enough money to pay for the remediation of the indoor air quality hazards. But that's not being very respectful to the low income communities.
Well, and yeah, that's one of the things we really want to be pushing. We want to be valuing not only the energy savings, but also those non-energy benefits. So, you know, how do we do that so that this transition is equitable and we are addressing those barriers to electrify? I know California has implemented something very recently called the Total System Benefit Framework, that does enable that, and happy to do a future one of these on a deeper dive into how that works so we can all learn more about it. But I know right now we're running out of time, but that would be an interesting subject. And also maybe we could hear from the folks in Pennsylvania that passed their healthy has effective there and learn more about the GAP fund that is being advanced here, which is a way to provide additional money for that work that needs to happen pre-electrification. There is going to be a lot more money coming. Not only do we have, you know, the NENI $5 billion, but we have the IRA rebates coming. And then we also have Cap and Invest, which, you know, knock on wood, is going to mean billions of dollars a year to invest in this transition. And we just want to keep building this movement so that we do make sure that it's equitable and that there is funding and evaluation on the health benefits and the non-energy benefits that we know are necessary in order to transition. So anyway, I will toss it back over to Eric for the last word on what we can do to take action. And I know we'll be following up with a lot more soon. And just again, really appreciate everyone being here and hope that we can continue this conversation in Zoom land and hopefully in person, and appreciate everybody's, you know, great work to move this forward. Eric?
Thanks, Betta. Just as we're a little over, thanks for everyone for staying over time. Just wanted to highlight again the organizational sign-on letter that I'm going to drop back into the chat. That is where we're looking to, again, deliver a letter to Commissioner, the Chair, Rory Christensen, along with the newly confirmed commissioners to advance these priorities in NENI that we talked about today, and for several other ways to take action, including developing your own organizational or individual comments. We'd love to hear more from other organizations and individuals in the docket. We're happy to support that through our NENI office hours. More about those offerings in the additional link, the NENI action link. So thanks so much, everyone, for joining us, and we'll look forward to hearing from you all soon.
Thanks, Eric. And we are hoping the comment deadline will be extended beyond April 15th, and we'll keep you posted. As soon as we hear that, we'll let you know. In the meantime, many of us will be working furiously to get those comments in and would be delighted to help you in whatever way we can. So thanks again, and we'll be in touch soon. Be well, everybody. And hopefully we save the chat. Did somebody, let's see, I can save it.
You said that you're saving too. The chat?
Stop recording.
Yes, oh, yeah. You should. Now we have to clip this part.
Did you save the chat, Mel, or should I?
It automatically saves on my computer, but could you stop the recording?
Recording. Record. Ding.
Hey, Marv.
Here we go. No, oh.
Hello?
No, it's not letting me stop the recording for some reason. It said record on this computer or record to the cloud. But it says it's recording.
Yeah, there should be on your screen a stop recording button.
There's not. It just says record.
End the meeting, and then it will stop.
Okay.
Okay. Let's just close out. Thanks, everybody, so much.
Thanks.
Okay, bye.
All right.